right. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. This is John Williams. Before we dive into our Monday conversation with Elise Link, normally at this time, a correction from the show you just heard as we were, and this is not our top story, but doggone it, we ought to get it right if we're going to do a contest.
It was my bad, too, but that song, See You in September, is by The Happenings.
That is not by The Happenings. It's by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. That's Frankie's little tiny voice there.
I've gotten calls, and I looked it up. It's by The Happenings. But I was just the one who said, did they have a Broadway play? And I think maybe that's where I steered everyone wrong.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I had it written down as Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, too. I grabbed the song and thought, that's Frankie Valli. The Happenings?
That's what it looks like.
Well, I just went back and listened to it. It is The Happenings.
I think Frankie Valli does that money song you start the show with.
Oh, that helps a lot. I'm going to find Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons singing that because God is my witness they did. But the version we played, I believe that was The Happenings.
The Happenings, yeah.
As it turns out, to win the hoodie from Mega, you can get all of the questions wrong, even if you're the host. So there's no money or love lost here, but thank you for the heads up on that, everybody, including you, Mike Langevin, and the rest of you. It's 12:09. Elise Link, do you even want to go on this show now? I mean, my goodness.
I don't know. I mean, if you can't get it right from always, I mean, is there any hope, John, right?
I mean, this is a business show now, and we would like to be as accurate as possible. Fortunately, we'll lean on you to do that. So,
well, it's good that you're not asking me what the title of songs are, because I always get it wrong. But good intentions, nonetheless.
Yeah, well, as my mother says, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Elise Glink is here, thinkglink.com. That's where you will find Elise, the real estate and financial wellness expert. Markets are off a little today. I don't know if it's worth making a lot to do about or not. What are you reading there?
Well, so the Dow is down, I don't know, 230-ish points, but we are still going to finish August for stock market development as the best and brightest since 1984. It's been a long time since we've seen an August this way. Now comes September and October, which are historically not great for the stock market, but in any case, everybody should be feeling pretty good if you've got any money in there right now.
Every financial metric we have these days that is really, really good is somewhat predicated on the fact that things were so terrible 5 months ago. And so I think that goes without saying, but I also think it's worth saying that maybe we've had the best uptick in August because July was so bad, right? I mean, relative to, you know, July was better than June, and June was better, but we went down so far so fast that all of these steps up are better, but they're only getting back to, in the Dow's case, where we were 9 months ago.
Well, we're a little bit ahead in some places. So, one of the things to think about, and this was not true for a while, is that the Russell 2000, which looks at sort of mid-cap funds, mid-cap stocks, and then you have small caps, and you've got the S&P 500, all of those are actually doing really well, as is the NASDAQ, which, you know, now NASDAQ is up some crazy high, just about another new high, record high, at 11,783. And I got to tell you that I remember NASDAQ when it was all a lot lower, and it wasn't that long ago. And so we've got some. Do you remember 5,000?
Yes.
Do you remember when it dropped all the way down to, like, I don't know, 600 or something? I mean, it's come a long way. And so I think that the stock market is actually doing pretty well, even compared with earlier in the year, and a lot of the indices are up over their January or February high. So that's kind of the good news. But I think we are seeing some trouble in other areas, and it is true what you say when you compare how well some things are doing. It's just because last month was so dreadful, and the month before was even more dreadful. And it's not that if you looked at it independently, you'd say, well, that's awfully good.
That's why, at least to me personally, the takeaway is which direction are we going? Is it getting better or is it getting worse? I feel that way about the COVID numbers. I feel that way about the economy. If we're going in the right direction, that's really all you can do right now.
Well, it's hard to imagine that we're going in the right direction when across the country you're seeing, you know, the kinds of civil unrest that actually close shops, and have people lose their jobs permanently instead of just being furloughed. And what we're seeing with the unemployment numbers, first-time unemployment numbers seem to be stuck around this 1 million or a little bit over 1 million a week. Again, if you compare it to anything that came before, all the way back to the Great Depression, like 80-something years ago, this is an unbelievably bad number, and the fact that we've had it now for 20-something weeks doesn't make me feel any better about it. And I know it's really starting to get on the nerves of people who are not only unemployed, but their kids who are also starting to feel the effects of that.
People that are dealing without another stimulus check right now or a supplement in their unemployment benefits, for that matter. Talk to me a little bit about bankruptcies. Talk to me a little bit about college loans and college students in a minute. Elise Glink from thinkglink.com. Elise Glink joins us. We're talking about finances, often about real estate. Also wanted to talk to you a little bit about bankruptcies and the 13 million college students who are worried about their financial future. Talk to me about the research on that. What are students thinking about, feeling about right now?
You know, it's interesting. I think that the panic that they're seeing in their parents' faces every day when they come home, plus the cost of college, a lot of that is now being discussed in a way that I think wasn't so clear before. Thinking about their financial future, what kind of a future they're going to grow into or graduate into has been tough. There are lots and lots of recent graduates out there, those who were seniors and graduated in June or May, and their job offers were either rescinded or pushed back. I know my own son had that happen where he was supposed to start his job in mid-June, and he's going to start now in mid-September. But many of his cohort don't even have start dates, and they were pushed into next year, maybe February, maybe March is what they're being told. And in the meantime, very difficult for them to find anything to do right now, and that makes kids really anxious because this is the year, and you know this, you know, with your own family. Yeah. I know it with mine. They want to get out and get started and go find a place to live and start living their adult lives. And all of that's been put on hold.
Plus, they've got the burden of the amount of money they owe just to get out. The average annual tuition at a four-year university, I'm just reading from a list now, private university average tuition plus room and board is $49,008, so $50,000 at a private school. And you're paying $22,000 at public institutions. I'm not sure
right,
what the average debt is that a college student has, but it's around $25,000, $30,000, something like that, I think.
Right. It's slightly over $30,000, and it starts getting that bill starts getting due about 6 months after you graduate. And so, you know, kids are anxious to go out and get those jobs and start to pay that back. What we're seeing, though, which is really interesting, is the largest number of millennials in history are now living with their parents again. Something like 30-35% of millennials who are aged up to about 38-39 right now have moved home. And you've got college students looking at their older siblings, looking at their friends in the neighborhood who have graduated and stayed at home. They are thinking that this is going to really change their financial future. And indeed it may, right? Especially if you're also seeing that young adults are increasingly dependent on their parents. So about 6 in 10 parents with children between the ages of 18 and 29 say they've given their kids at least some financial help in the last year, primarily for recurring expenses, tuition, rent, groceries, or bills, according to Pew Research Center. And about 6.4 million are getting help with their credit card bills. So there's still this reliance into your 20s on your parents that I think is worrying for parents because those parents are trying to think about retirement readiness and really worrying about, for kids about whether they're going to be able to afford any sort of life for themselves.
I did not play on my show today. I will probably tomorrow the audio of a woman who she identified her age. I don't remember what it is. She's maybe 30 or so, and she's doing a TikTok video where she's explaining how frustrating it is to not be able to dig herself out of her college debt, her tuition debt. And she's screaming and pounding the table and slapping her forehead going, this is so messed up. I'll never get, and she's like, and people are giving her a lot of love and support. And I feel bad for these people, but I don't exactly understand what she doesn't understand. If you borrow money at an interest rate, and she was saying, I've paid all of this money and I still owe this much more. And I thought, yeah, that's how we buy cars and houses. And that, I mean, and
well, so you're many... talking to the you're talking to a person who spent has spent her entire career trying to help people understand the basics of something as simple as compounding interest.
Yeah.
And it just is so hard for some people to get, especially young people, because they think to themselves, well, I'm borrowing $30,000 or I'm borrowing $50,000. And what they don't realize is that with the interest tacked on, you're actually borrowing more like $150,000 or $75,000. And if that number ever was really revealed to people at the beginning, I think they'd think more than twice about it, which is exactly what you're seeing happen now. The idea that you can't even be on campus and enjoy yourself at college is making kids push colleges to give them a tuition rebate or a tuition cut because they can't enjoy the things that they're supposedly paying for, which brings up the bigger question of what exactly is college worth today?
I think that's a good question. I think it's too expensive, and I also will say that the universities and colleges are complicit to this degree. I think they should help families monitor the debt they're incurring. After, this is just me. This is my crazy theory. But after your sophomore year, if you are going to be owing a multiple of what you're going to be earning when you get a full-time job, there needs to be a reset, a pause. Like maybe you shouldn't go to this university anymore because you're going to be straddled for the rest of your life with two car payments in student debt. I'm just reading from NerdWallet right now. $37,200 in loans is the average amount a high school kid graduating today is going to have. $37K. That's okay if you can pay it off in time. But if you're $50,000, $75K and you can't, and you're crying on a TikTok video, maybe you should have realized that before. God, I sound like a boomer now. Before you got into that situation.
Well, okay, boomer to you, John. But the, you know, part of the problem is I don't think that people know what they're going to be able to afford and what kind of job they're going to be able to get. And when you were graduating into the hottest job market in history in February, or at least you thought that's what you were graduating into,
yeah.
And you've watched, that's one thing. What we see now is perhaps there's an entirely different world awaiting us on the other side of COVID. And it's very hard for anybody to know when they start college in the U.S. It's different how they handle it in Europe and Australia and Canada, where you kind of skip college and go straight into graduate school. You decide where you're going. You spend 3 or 4 years getting there, and then you pretty much have a path that's predetermined for you. In this country, we spend 4 years doing some general things. Some people know they want to be engineers. Some people have no idea what they want to do, and they go and get an English degree, and then they figure it out after. So it's a little bit hard to know if you're going to get an English degree. Well, did that mean that you were going to be an English teacher, or are you going to go work for a tech company and run communications? And there's a really big difference in how much money you're going to make if you go to work for a tech company in communications versus, you know, be an English teacher versus be just a freelance writer. So we have to do a better job of helping guide our young people into the various different options that are out there for them and what those pay so that, to your point, we can reverse engineer it back into what they should be spending for the education they're going to get.
I'm glad you pointed out that a lot of kids are graduating into a market that is awful, and they could not have known that was coming. So I think that's a fair point to make. Any other news about the markets these days? I see that the airlines stocks are trading in a pretty good direction, correct?
They are. I do just want to point out, we didn't get into the bankruptcy stuff, but let me just point out that major Chinese banks are starting to see write-downs for bad debts. And that's a really interesting sign. They're posting 10% year-on-year declines for profit, even as they set aside more funds for potential losses. And we need to think about that here in the U.S. because bankruptcies are already rising to levels we haven't seen in 10 years. For example, there's been over 420 filings for public companies, bankruptcy filings. 43 retailers have, so far this year, filed for bankruptcy, including Lord & Taylor just last week, Tailored Brands, which is part of Men's Warehouse, and many, many others.
A story breaking today, Elise, the Palmer House Hotel has been hit with the foreclosure lawsuit.
Oh, so this is, and we haven't even begun to talk about real estate bankruptcies in the commercial space with everybody changing how they're working, Steve, and where it's going. I think we're seeing, you know, large swaths of these tall, beautiful buildings in downtowns across the world, but particularly in the U.S., that are empty and they never get filled up again. And that's going to be a problem for these loans, because these loans are typically 5 or 7 year loans. They're not 30 year loans like we get for houses. And the way that those properties get valued by lenders is the percent that they are occupied and what is the rate that people are actually paying. So if you've got half empty buildings, those properties won't appraise in value, and those properties will then all be underwater, which I think is why Sam Zell last week said that we weren't near the bottom yet for commercial real estate. And as always, he's watching that. And I think we should all pay attention, because what happens in that market is going to be very critical to how we come out of this coronavirus recession and where we actually are. And that gets us back to where you started, John.
Are the Sam Zells of the world out there scooping up some of this stuff, or will they be at some point? I mean...
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. He's watching it like a hawk, and the fact that he even talked about it tells you what he thinks is going to happen, and I happen to agree. I think we're in for a real shock when it comes to real estate vacancies.
Sam Zell, famously the owner of Tribune Media, which included this radio station in the Chicago Tribune. It's nice to talk to you, Elise Glink. Stay well.
You too, John. Thank you.
Catherine Davis joins us now on WGN Radio. You're listening to the Wind Trust Business Lunch. Catherine, welcome back. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Really good. You're the associate editor at Chicago Inno. Visit chicagoinno.com. Let's talk about the tech-forward real estate brokerage that is helping people sell their homes these days. You wrote about that.
Yeah, so this is a new Chicago startup that actually just popped up this summer. You know, it's kind of Chicago Inno's bread and butter, is writing about new businesses, new tech-forward businesses. And this startup called AnyCurb really fits into that description. So basically, you know, you can think of them like a Zillow, but a little bit more proactive. So they have algorithms and, you know, different methods of figuring out when homeowners may be willing to sell their homes even if they haven't actually put them on the market yet. So the idea is, you know, they're looking for people who just became empty nesters, or if their neighbors are also selling their homes, and they'll approach them and say, hey, you know, putting your home on the market can be a complicated process. If you're interested, we can help you do that and get a good market price for your home.
Realtors, I guess, have been doing that sort of thing for years. Sometimes they'll leave a little flyer on your door when a market or neighborhood is hot. But this, I'm going to get a ping on my phone, and I have no intention of selling my home, saying, hey, everybody else is. Maybe you should think about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it sort of works like that. You know, I think the way AnyCurb kind of differentiates itself from, you know, a traditional real estate brokerage is that, you know, they have algorithms and, you know, this tech platform behind it that really streamlines those decision-making processes that, you know, help you identify different homeowners and when they may be ready to sell. You know, on the flip side, for the consumers, for home buyers, the founder was telling me that their platform gives home buyers more options because they're able to see homes that aren't even on the market yet.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I guess, boy, there's a niche. So is this a real estate firm, though? That is, do they also sell the property, or do they then hand it off to a realtor?
No, so they do everything. They do it, you know, from point of finding the homeowner down to selling it and closing the actual sale. Right now they, you know, mainly list homes from Naperville, but, you know, they want to expand throughout the suburban Chicago area as well as Chicago proper, and eventually throughout the country. So they've got big plans, but, you know, they're just kind of one of many real estate startups here in Chicago.
Mm. Interesting. 3D printers were all the rage, it seems, a year or two ago. I haven't heard much from them lately. You did a story about that. What's the Chicago connection here?
Yeah, so there's a Skokie startup called Azul 3D, and, you know, they are known for their, highly customizable 3D printers. And so, you know, they're selling these printers to third-party companies where it makes sense. But we wrote about them last week because they raised $12.5 million, just following $8 million that they raised in May. And, you know, most of this funding right now is being used to print personal protective equipment to fight the coronavirus pandemic. You know, so far they've been providing the equipment that they're printing to hospitals and prisons, first responders, you know, people throughout the Chicago area, and even elsewhere, and sort of, you know, really using their tech in a really much needed way right now.
Yeah, no kidding. When I think of PPE these days, I mostly think of face masks. I don't presume they're printing those. Maybe shields, those dividers, that sort of thing?
Yeah, they're printing the face shields primarily. Oh. They say they can do about 1,000 per, like, a 12-hour shift.
Hmm. And this is based in Skokie, huh?
Based in Skokie.
Talk to me about the Chicago fishing lure that is getting some attention these days.
Yeah, so this is an interesting startup. You know, they don't really have a big tech element, which is kind of different for Chicago, you know, coverage, but the company is called Catch Co. Basically, they sell fishing gear, and they do it through a subscription box. So, you know, if you're familiar with some of those other ones like FabFitFun, where you get a box on a monthly or, you know, quarterly basis, and it has, you know, a bunch of cool items in it, and it's super fun to open every time you get it. That's kind of what Catch Co. is, but for the fishing enthusiast. And, you know, amid COVID, when everyone, you know, has their lives have changed dramatically, they're spending a lot more time at home, probably spending a lot more time outside, Catch Co. has seen sales, you know, considerably increase. They say that in March they were up 115% year over year. April sales were up nearly 200% because people are, you know, picking up new hobbies, and fishing seems to be one of them.
Your colleague Jim Dalkey's reporting on it said that, and I don't see the exact spot here now, that NBA players are picking these up. That's helping out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the NBA is kind of in that bubble in Florida and Disney World. You know, they've been posting on their social media channels that they're using some of the gear from Catch Co. As, you know, they're also looking for ways to pass the time during this COVID era.
Ben Simmons, Paul George and Company. That's not a bad endorsement there. By the way, let's just go back to COVID-19 for a second. You guys also had a story inside six Chicago tech firms or efforts that are fighting COVID-19. Where are we on that front, and what's this all about?
Yeah, so this is what we call crisis innovators. You know, it was actually a piece that was rolled out across the Inno markets all over the country. And, you know, what we really wanted to do with this was highlight, you know, people and businesses locally that have, you know, really innovated to help fight the pandemic. So, you know, just a couple examples. There's a researcher at Northwestern, John Rogers, who developed a small wearable patch that's worn on the neck, and it can catch early signs of the coronavirus. So it's using artificial intelligence to detect suspicious coughing or weird respiratory activity. But, you know, this is actually being used at health systems, particularly at Northwestern, to help nurses and doctors manage COVID. Another example is the U of I. They have created a COVID-19 test that they've been using to test their students and faculty as they return to campus this fall. But, you know, as opposed to some of the other tests that use a throat or nasal swab, the U of I test is using saliva, and it can give you results in a matter of hours. So, you know, that's just a couple of the efforts that we highlighted. But, you know, as you can kind of tell, these are, you know, biotech forward and innovative solutions to fighting this enduring COVID-19 pandemic.
I forget what the number was, but I saw a percentage last week of the total COVID tests in America as it relates to the COVID tests at Champaign-Urbana, and it's a high number. It's like 6 or 7 or something percent of the COVID tests on any given day in the United States are being done at the U of I campus because the students are back and they're doing it twice
right.
a week. And I think that's just remarkably robust and innovative. I hope it continues to go well down there. We are hearing, Catherine, that it has been going well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, this could really be something that would be rolled out all over the country, you know, if it's allowed. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave emergency approval to U of I's test earlier this month. So, you know, it's certainly catching traction, and if it continues to work, I think we'll see it elsewhere, not just on campus.
Catherine Davis, Associate Editor, Chicago Inno, chicagoinno.com. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, John.
I was going to say, well, what do you know, there's some good news on that front. It's good news about a pandemic, but we'll take the good news as we can get it. We'll take the business news with Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. United Airlines is dumping its $200 change fee for most people who change a ticket for travel in the U.S. That could put pressure on American and Delta to follow suit. Southwest doesn't charge the fee. McDonald's former head of human resources is emerging as a focus of the company's investigation into possible improprieties under former CEO Steve Easterbrook. The Wall Street Journal says David Fairhurst was fired for cause last November. And Chicago Inno says the Discovery Partners Institute, which is a network of research and innovation hubs in the South Loop, has awarded more than $1 million in grants to innovators at local schools who are working on everything from developing autonomous tech to tracing COVID-19. The grants are being given to 8 teams out of the 55 that applied. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
On the farm biz front now, this is Orion Samuelson.
And guess what? We've got a weather market going in the grain trade at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybean futures hit their highest prices in more than 2 years today, as dry weather in parts of the Midwest expected to damage the condition of crops. Wheat futures also advanced, while corn futures sort of eased. So we'll look at the prices. The September wheat contract is up a nickel a bushel at 5.44 and a quarter. September corn up 3 cents at $3.49 a bushel. September soybeans trading higher, up 3 1/4 cents at $9.54 and a quarter cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the October lean hog contract is trading up 15 cents a hundredweight, $53.80. August live cattle up $1.27 at $104.50 a hundredweight. And the September feeder cattle market is trading $1.05 higher at $141.07. Wisconsin agricultural leaders will hold a virtual town hall on the future of the Wisconsin agriculture with focus on the dairy industry. Panelists will discuss the emerging developments and opportunities, as well as take questions from conversation participants. And the hosts are the National Milk Producers Federation, the U.S. Dairy Export Council. Moderator will be former Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, who is now the President and CEO of the U.S. Dairy Export Council. Panelists will include Jim Mulhern, President and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation, Jeff Schwager, President of Sartori Cheese, Jeff Lyon, CEO, Farm First Dairy Cooperative, and Randy Romansky, who is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. And then a reminder, as we leave August and move into September, that month is the month of the Grand Island, Nebraska, Husker Harvest Days, and the Farm Progress Show at Boone, Iowa. That's all taking place virtually, and the dates will be September 15, 16, and 17. And you can get further information on how to dial in to the virtual presentation of the two shows at farmprogress.com. And you might add marketing to that email address, marketing, farmprogress.com, September 15 through the 17th. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth reports on business on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's rolling while we got you, Amy. How are you today?
Hi, John. Happy Monday. How are you?
Likewise. Let's start with the airline business. You frequently focus on that for us. What's the news there today?
Yeah, I do like to watch the airline industry, particularly this year, because it's just gone through such radical transformations due to the pandemic and how much travel has dropped. So as a result of that, you know, you and I have been talking about the moves that airlines have been making to try to keep up and try to survive all that's going on. Of course, there is a looming deadline out there of October 1st when they received federal funding. One caveat was you can have this money, but you can't lay off anybody until October 1st. So that's preserved a lot of jobs through the summer. But now that it's almost September, I think a lot of people are really feeling the pressure of that deadline. So as such, United, just over the weekend, said that it has put a stop to its change fee for domestic flights. I think we've all been there, right? You get the airport a little early and you go, you know, I could get on this earlier flight. Can you put me on there? And then there's this change fee to do it. You think, oh, it's not even worth it. So they have scrapped that fee permanently. A lot of airlines had temporarily paused that fee, just trying to get people onto planes and try to incentivize. But that was all temporary. So they're the first airline that said, okay, we're going to do away with that. That's about a $200 fee for United in their case. It's various prices at various airlines. But that's something they're going to scrap. As a result, I think we'll see what happens next. There will probably be, I mean, it seems like, you know, Southwest doesn't do that quite that way. They're a little more flexible with changes. So it seems like the pressure's probably just been amped up a little bit on Delta and American to take a look at their fee structure and think, okay, if United and Southwest are doing this, how can we reclaim some of that business? American, they have made a 55% reduction to their October schedule. We kind of knew this was coming, but what they have done in addition to that is they've also added on a lot of warm weather destinations. We kind of knew that part was coming too, but they made that a little more official. So things like Florida, Mexico, stuff like that. That said, some of the flights that we kind of know are always there that we depend on from American, they're going to be really cut. I mean, a 55% reduction. And the moment that takes effect will be about the time when typically summer travel starts to taper off and business travel sort of spikes up. But because both of those have been hit so hard, we're going to see how that plays out for them and see, I'm going to watch American very closely and see how that strategy plays for them. But, you know, I think a lot of airlines right now are kind of watching each other's moves and going, okay, they did that, so we better respond. And I think it's going to be really interesting the next several months not only to see what happens with their employment when we're talking about potentially massive, massive layoffs happening in October across airline carriers, not just here in the U.S., but also, you know, Lufthansa is, you know, they're having these conversations. We're seeing this. This is widespread. But also how they're going to change their structure and their strategy to incentivize people to pick them over other airlines.
I didn't realize the rescheduling fee was $200. I don't reschedule flights that often. $200, huh?
Yeah, I'm with you. I try not to do that too, but you know, once in a while your flight gets in early and you think, oh, my connecting flight, yeah, I could take the earlier one.
Right.
And so, you know, things like that. I think that'll be interesting to see what happens. My guess is, and this is only speculation, but my guess is that American and Delta will probably make a similar move of some sort to try to say, hey, we're playing in that space too. We're looking at our fee structure as well.
Coca-Cola is laying people off. Sales have been off since we don't go to movie theaters and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. You know, if you recall, very early in this crisis, we were talking about Coca-Cola because their first quarter and second quarter results really showed really quite a bit of movement there. And it was largely a part because such a big chunk of their business is not going to the store and buying a Coke out of a, you know, from the bottle or buying a 6-pack or 12-pack or whatever of Coke. It's the big accounts from sports events and concerts and movie theaters and things like that. All of those things being closed, that's been a massive hit to Coca-Cola's revenue, as we saw as they've started to lay out their numbers of what's happened so far this year. So they're offering a voluntary restructure, a voluntary layoff package. So they're starting with about 4,000 workers in the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico. They had to have been hired before September of 2017, and they're hoping this will limit the number of involuntary cuts that they will have to do later, because they're talking about just huge numbers where they're going to probably be falling short of their numbers of what they need to do to keep going. Now with this, it's not just about that number. With this, operationally, they have 17 different business units, because if you think about all the stuff Coca-Cola owns, they're going to kind of knock that down and replace it with 9 divisions. So from 17 to 9, that are going to focus on the products that really are their big revenue drivers. They had been venturing into some new stuff and they had some smaller brands, but of course, Coke as we know it, the namesake soda brand, that's here to stay. Sparkling kind of juices and waters, things like that, that's around. The sports drinks, that's around. But then also like the milk and plant milk kind of area and a couple of emerging categories, that's all going to be part of their focus. But they've really restructured to do a lot of consolidation. So my guess is this is not going to be the last we've heard about some really quick shifts to Coke's business model.
And lastly, Walgreens has got a shakeup, or at least they're replacing the CEO, right?
Well, so this is really interesting because throughout this year, we haven't seen a lot of like really fierce business competition because the environment has just kind of been everybody sort of hanging on and trying to make it for the most part. But in the pharmacy area, you have kind of 2 things, changing healthcare of what that looks like, which has been accelerated by the pandemic, and you also have a vastly changing retail space. We've talked about the many reasons why. E-commerce, different customer needs, things like that. Walgreens and CVS have both been kind of playing almost in the grocery and deli business as well as pharmaceutical and healthcare. So there's pretty fierce competition there. But, so Walgreens has now poached a former Rite Aid, the former Rite Aid CEO. He's going to run the U.S. business part. Now this comes at the same time, when Stefano Messina, who is the longtime CEO of Walgreens, said he was going to be stepping down as CEO and he was going to be chairman of the an executive chairman role. So there's a lot of change happening in Walgreens, but again, it's really, I think the focus, the place to look is really the competition between those two, Walgreens and CVS, in a moment when there's so much change around the business that those two things handle.
Amy Guth, following the business scene, airlines frequently, some of these other areas as well. We'll visit again. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.